No, we don't waste.
The problem is I don't know exactly the name of the person we're interviewing.
Well, that's
the
ask him.
That's not fair. So, all right. So, who are you?
I'm Brad.
Hi, Brad. Nice to meet you. Charles. I don't know.
Hi, Charles. Hi.
So, this is part of Robert and I are going around the company, and we're doing this show called .NET at Microsoft, where we're hunting, searching, and actually finding a lot of folks that are actually using .NET and shipping products, either for internal usage or external usage. And so you're working on something called Metropolis.
Yep.
Right? So what is Metropolis? What's going on?
Metropolis is a smart client that it's a customer systems application, and it is an application that's used by the guy that you talk to when you got a problem with the product. You pick up your phone, you call the number, you say, why won't this Word macro work for me?
Yeah.
So the guy answers the phone and he starts using Metropolis. Metropolis is a general term for the platform that we put out. Agent Desktop is the application that really adds. And so it's
and that explains why we're not in Redmond anymore, right?
Yeah, this is IT.
Well, we're here. It's the Sammamish campus is mostly product support, right? Or it was.
Yeah.
I don't know if it is anymore.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I don't keep track of it all, but it is definitely IT.
Okay.
It's not product group stuff. We're the red line, red ink guys.
Yeah. Interesting. So it's a smart client, so WinForm-based client application.
Yep, WinForm-based, then it has .NET Web Services, middle tier, and Yukon SQL Server 2005
backend.
Nice. So that's pretty much the deal. Now, from a .NET story, I would back up in front of Metropolis, too, mm-hmm. just to talk about my favorite way to talk about .NET experience was even the pre-beta experience. We evolved out of eSupport. There was the project that was before where we were the web-based service request system. That was when we first got introduced to .NET. And we were in the midst of planning it. I mean, it was an application that just, you know, every year rolled out the new technology. It started as CGI, and then it went to ASAP, or ASP, mm-hmm. or ISAPI, and then ASP, and then .NET came around. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we were in the middle of rolling out what was going to be a COM-related revision of the whole thing, and then all of a sudden there was this talk that there is this something or other called .NET that was on the horizon that we probably should understand mm-hmm. before we started betting on an architecture. And I tell this story just because it was so cool in that we went to our boss and said, you know, we really need to go check this out. And after he got finished saying that we had gone completely schizophrenic and that he was looking for stability and we were talking about replacing all of the architecture, he said, give us 2 weeks to have three people, 2 weeks just to go out and put together a prototype. And we'll do the whole thing, a client to a web service to a Unicode-based SQL server. And we'll either prove the technology or we won't, but just if we can do it. And what was just so incredible about it, this was more than any experience that I've had at Microsoft, was going into new technology. This wasn't even beta technology, by the way. This was pre-beta. Really, it had problems, especially with like the UI and stuff. But when we got in 2 weeks, we were able to put together this prototype of that went from client all the way up to the server in Unicode with multiple languages. I mean, some of the toughest problems we've ever had to solve, and it was just done, and it was done in 2 weeks, and it was a delight.
Nice.
It was just fun. It just worked, and it was amazingly stable, and it wasn't even beta yet.
This was back when, in 2000?
Yeah, this would have been, well, whenever .NET was getting ready to go beta, and I'm just...
Yeah.
You know,
2000. I remember those days. Yeah. I guess the SDR started, or the TAP program started in December of 99. So, yeah. 2000.
Well, that's awesome.
So we went back to management. I mean, and really the phrase that got used a lot around here was, don't ask me whether we should use .NET or not. Ask me, you tell me why we shouldn't use .NET.
Now let's talk about why. So what was it that made it so... delightful, as you said. Let's step back for a second. You're an architect, developer. I mean, you write code.
Yeah. So what was it about this new object-oriented paradigm you were playing with called .NET, or that really you loved so much as a developer? That's what I'm getting at.
Right. As a developer, there was the IDE, Visual Studio IntelliSense. Put that one at the top of the list. The code writes itself. I mean, you could sit down and be productive. You sit down and in a couple hours you write 200 lines of code and it just works. Yeah. You just hit F5 and it just goes. It just works the first time. Yeah. You gotta love that. I mean, just typing it in, it does wonders for your ego to begin with.
Sure.
And I mean, you just get hooked on it right away. I mean, it was just like, it didn't take long. After a couple of weeks, you just think, I can't give this up. I could never go back to C++ again. Mm-hmm. You know, garbage collection, all those things that in code reviews you would go through, and you always had your little list of all those things to look for, where you're not closing handles, you know, every time you open this thing. And suddenly you just had these constructs like using statements, and we were all C#. There was no VB or anything. We were a C# kind of a project. Mm-hmm. But there were just constructs that just made everything make sense. So you just knew that your product was going to be more solid just by the very nature of the infrastructure that you were using to put it out. I mean, mm-hmm. you could start looking for things and it was just built in. The one of the downsides is we probably were a little too oversold on garbage collection, and being naive, had to learn the hard way that really inventive developers are still capable of leaking memory when they want to, so and it can be done. And it was, you know, that was the subtle things, you know, you heard the promise, but it's like you find out later that, well, there are things, if you're not really smart, maybe it isn't leaking, but what's the definition of a link? If it doesn't get reclaimed fast enough, is it leaking or is it not?
Exactly.
So there are things, and so there's a learning curve there too, and we've probably gone both ways now, been overzealous about disposing of things and not being zealous enough about disposing of things. So.
Sure. What's your background? How long have you worked here at Microsoft? And
I've been at Microsoft for, 13 years?
Wow.
Probably in the industry for 25 or so.
So you probably learned assembler, C++, you know, or C, and then...
Yeah, it's been...
You didn't learn C# 25 years ago.
No. C# was when .NET came out.
Yep.
So, I mean, that would have been it. It was, you know, I've always been C or C++,
okay,
pretty much. You know, before Microsoft, there was always... I don't know, Unix was around. I never had to deal with that much, thank goodness. But it was nice coming to Microsoft, and all of a sudden, all this stuff just was... Yes, you will use SQL Server, you will be writing under Windows. You will. It's like, hey, I don't have any work to do here. This is like, we already know our platform. How cool is that?
All right.
So, but we digress.
Yeah, so digressing, we're famous for digressions.
Asides and digressions.
Yeah.
That is Channel 9.
That is Channel 9.
This is the second birthday at Channel 9, by the way.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
So. 2 years.
2 years of doing this kind of stuff.
Totally.
So how many of these kinds of things do you do in a given month?
We do 2 to 3 interviews a day.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
And then of course we have to process them and get them reviewed and edit them, and then
the end result is a new video every day.
Every day, at least one
really?
A day.
Yeah. Really.
And we have a big queue right now, so
yeah.
Things are good.
We can slack off.
And the thing also, we have a lot of people around the company that are making content for us.
Yeah.
Right. Lots of podcasts, lots of screencasts. Uh-huh. We've made Channel 9 such that Microsoft employees can enter security groups like screencasters or podcasters, and they'll be able to just from the UI, it's an ASP.NET based app,
mm-hmm.
From the UI upload their screencast or podcast files, create the post, and we don't have to be involved at all. Robert and I are the only ones that can do the videos, really.
Uh-huh.
But that's just because that's just the way it is.
Oh, job security.
Job security.
Well, job security. We want to have control over that.
Yeah.
But that now we really digress. This is about you.
Okay.
So let's talk about Metropolis architecture again. So let's continue with your .NET story.
Okay, so that was basically, you know, that was eSupport, and that's where we got, and I say we because really that whole project team became Metropolis. We kind of got rolled in, and then Metropolis was kind of bigger. And so... part of, to understand the real benefit too, I think it, you have to understand some of what we had to deal with on a global scale. We want product support to be a global type of thing, and we would like it to be the same in Australia as it is in Germany, as it is anywhere else. And given that we have different business processes, that's hard enough to deal with. But we're also dealing with legacy systems, third-party systems that have no concept of a global implementation. And so what we really have is 8 different installations of exactly the same database, of the exact same client, and then regionally different parts of the globe talk to these. So part of our work coming into this had always been to write code that makes all those different systems talk to each other.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was part of what eSupport did, and then we went to .NET and we started doing that sort of thing. Metropolis comes along, and part of what Metropolis wants to do is get rid of that. There was some, you know, some of the big architectural statements that you got to decide up front is, do we take the same pattern for performance reasons? Do we have a distributed model where we'll put the processing closer to the client and deal with the data replication and the master data? Or do you hope that your networks will be good enough so that you can single source your data and make everybody make the long trip? But so you have to kind of weigh that. Well, ultimately where we ended up is we decided that we were going to go with the single source of the data and deal with performance and all that other stuff. We felt we could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. And actually, as it turns out, big win. I mean, we risked, I'm actually pretty proud of it, that what we've done with UConn and with the web services and caching at different levels, and then really going to the fat client, we had been web-based before this,
mm-hmm.
at least in our experience, but having that ability to have the fat client and be able to write such robust code and get all the benefits of client-side caching and just all that kind of stuff mm-hmm. enabled us to, when we went through all of our network performance tests and all of that stuff, I mean, should have the letter hanging up from the network guys coming back saying, in my 8 years of testing applications, this is the most network efficient application that I've ever seen at Microsoft. And that's just cool.
That's fantastic.
It is. And so as we roll out around the world, it's just we're not having performance problems. I mean, we've got lots of stuff where we know exactly how long every transaction takes. Is it from the client? We can roll all this stuff up and it goes on through all the way to the database, and we can just capture timings at every little level, and
wow.
We produce a heat map every day that we can know, well, in Australia they're suffering from something's going wrong, and you find out that, you know, AD is failing to authenticate fast enough, or there's
mm-hmm.
things like that. So
that's awesome.
And
so you're using in your database, it's Unicode, right?
Yes.
So that solves your
huge savings. Huge.
Yeah.
Always had trouble with the Asian languages, right? With the Clarify installations that we have,
mm-hmm.
when you get into the Chinese language and it's not Unicode database, so it's code pages. And so to move things around, you still have problems escalated. Still, there's people that will ask a SQL Server question, and the expertise may exist only in England or something, or Redmond or something, and so they'll escalate it, but getting that data across without it just turning into garbage is, and so from that aspect, yeah, that was going Unicode all the way there was no thought anymore. You just didn't have to worry about it. Words were words, text was text, and you just let the whole infrastructure take care of it.
Now, what is this, if I'm a product support person using this app, what does it look like? Is it a form-based app? Type? What kinds of things does the app do? Does Metropolis do?
It is a forms-based app. It is... Boy, I'd say I could show it to you, but I don't know what will happen on my dev box if I try to launch it.
Yeah.
I mean, is that something you would want to see?
Sure, of course.
Yeah.
So it's a Windows Forms application for the UI.
Yes, it is.
And of course, everything else, there's no UI associated with it. So this is it.
Actually, that's Visual Studio.
Yeah, there won't be any customer data being shown here, will there?
No.
Okay, good. That's the only thing I have to worry about. It's privacy and all that fun stuff.
Now, speaking of .NET, there's, as I start this up, it occurs to me, so what's really going to be happening here?
Yeah.
So, let's see if we can hit some of the key points. So we've got, we're going to have partners and stuff worldwide, some in untrusted domains and things like that. So we pop that thing up, and basically they've got a list of the URLs, production versus training, that sort of thing. Anyway, so we log in. I'm just going to use my domain credentials. But one of the first things that it does is as it logs in, every user is mapped to a particular version of the client in the database. Mm-hmm. And we send down some XML. This is all driven by XML. Everything we do is XML. So the XML goes down and basically sends a manifest that says, here's the assemblies that you need. And you can see my machine is out of date because it recognized there's two files that are just out of date. They're not what this particular environment that I'm logging into is expecting. Mm-hmm. So we go out to download it. Here's where .NET remoting comes in. This was also one of these huge, huge wins. I wish I remembered the numbers, but we have, from my experience in the past, dealing again with e-support and web-based submissions, there was always a need to move a file, move some sort of binary file. So they downloaded it in the app and now reset everything and then start back up again. And hopefully I should be running a version that will work in whatever environment I pick. And I wish I could remember the number of lines of code that we got to throw away when it came time to move some binary bits across an HTTP pipe. We use the HTTP because you get the SSL, the encryption for free, and you get the authentication for free. And so this is the launch pad that's still warming up, and I'm probably hitting an environment. Most of this delay is getting the web services started up and everything.
Sure.
But then .NET remoting comes along. And now you get to write a class, and you know in the past you opened up sockets and you converted binary and you ASCII encoded it and you put it on the pipe and you looped through and you sent all this kind of stuff. And then with .NET remote, and then you had to have code at the server that knew how to read what the client was sending, and you built your own handshaking in and so that you could go back and forth and whatever it would be. But then .NET remoting comes along and you write an object. It's just an object that you say, move some bits. You configure it as a remoting component, and then it resides both at the server and the client. Mm-hmm. And the client doesn't know when he creates that object, it's really creating the object over on the server. But the code, the paradigm that the coder gets is simply, move my bits. And then under the covers, it just moves them. Mm-hmm. And it works out so well because we have the client that would be anywhere around the world that has to go over HTTP, so it really does have to do the work of negotiating it over the pipe. But then we also have other components like that are server-side components, a Windows service for managing inbound emails. Same sort of thing where we still want to put an attachment onto a record. We use exactly the same object, only this time we just turn the remoting off because we aren't really remoting it. We're already on the server, we're in the place where it is, but it's the same code. It's just exactly the same code. We're just saying, don't instantiate me remotely, just use this exactly, and then it just works exactly the same way.
Excellent.
Way cool. You know, you write it once and you just get to use it in whatever situation it makes sense.
That's
and then
fantastic.
Where they're going with the Windows Communication Foundation is just .NET remoting on steroids, so
yeah.
We're kind of looking for it. So anyway, this application is kind of set up. This is the shell, and the shell is pretty much that. It's just, it's infrastructure. It provides a lot of just the caching and real generic stuff, but it doesn't do anything. It's really dumb. And the way Metropolis is built, we just dynamically load assemblies. If the manifest sends down that you have permissions to do decode is an application. So what we have is different groups. There's a group over in SAMD over there that is they're still the guys that do the web-based support. So it's kind of tied in, and what they do is they write an assembly, a .NET assembly, that they provide to us, and we just distribute with this. And by virtue of the fact that it just exists, and the manifest says to use it, we'll just load it, and he plugs himself in, and now he's just part of the application. So Agent Desktop is, this is our bread and butter. This is what the agents around the world will use. And I'm probably not the best guy to know the details of how it is, but I mean, there's, we come in and all of this stuff is, we've made a number of, by this time, a number of web service calls, and we've gotten cached items down, so we have lists of domains and phone masks and support options and all that kind of stuff already loaded. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you're on the phone and they say, hi, I'm whoever I am. Mm-hmm. And they'll search for the customer, and they'll either find him or they won't. And so they're going to create a new customer. And,
Understood. So this is what the support people use when you're talking to them on the phone.
Yeah, this is basically it. So they'll get the customer information. They'll say, well, this was a pre-sales inquiry about products, and here's what I'm doing. So this is kind of that upfront. This is the very first interaction that Microsoft has. And so There's some other integration. We do some screen scraping off of some Clarify, some legacy systems, some things until the full, you know, ultimately the idea is to replace the legacy systems, but until then we'll be dealing with them. And so, you know, all this this stuff goes along. .NET provides an internal browser control. See, that's what happens when you do demos on the fly.
That's fine. But
I mean, basically, yeah. So whatever it is, it's not loading, and it's probably because I'm not seeing a URL that should be loading a browser control. Mm. And
that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so let's talk about when you talk about so you're dynamically loading assemblies based on the context you're in, right? So how are you dynamically loading the assemblies? You're just using, like, using assembly.load, or are you using...
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I mean, that's a very interesting thing. It's like loading a library, used to be.
Right.
Sort of.
Yeah, it's pretty analogous to that same thing. And so the thing is built, and there's a pattern. So when you're a subscribing assembly, there's an interface that you have to implement. Mm-hmm. And so we publish an IE something or other interface, I'm not sure what the name of it is anymore. And so as we load it, then we say, you know, we're getting ready to load you, go do whatever you need to get ready to be loaded, and mm-hmm. say, okay, now we are loading you, and then another message says, now we're loading everybody else, and now, okay, now everybody's loaded, you get a last shot at doing something else now, because now you can count on your cache manager exists, and your user manager exists, and so, you know, we'll fire off all of that stuff through the delegation models provided in .NET and C#, and so everybody just receives their messages, and everyone just reacts, and you just kind of move on.
Marvelous. So it's basically a evolving application that can be. So in other words, as an assembly maker in one of these other buildings around here, I can actually evolve the application in the sense that, you know, I produce some really killer assembly that does some super new feature. And I implement your interface, and people use me, and now they have a better application or a more feature rich. I mean, that's one of the beautiful things about .NET, as you just mentioned earlier, is the way it's really easy for applications to self-update, which it was doing at the beginning.
Right. Right. And there's a whole lot of options. I mean, that's what's neat is that you get to choose. It isn't just a one-size-fits-all. There were things that we did. We can use the one-click. There are things that .NET provides natively that goes, but we needed a little more control because we don't really, I mean, we have to launch the application, be running to actually connect to the database mm-hmm. in the environment in order to make a table join to find out what version he's supposed to be using. Mm-hmm. So in our case, it was a little more complicated than just click G, no, there's a new update, everyone should have the new update.
Okay.
So we also have, you know, then we needed to be able to, you know, you get deployed in production, and then just as a smoke test, a production support person might go in and set up a schedule for himself that says, on Tuesday between 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock, download the new version to me. And so he will just get just that version for himself, and then at 4 it would revert back to what is supposed to be the version.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so you've got that kind of stuff, and...
So could I just mention quickly, so look, can we talk about scale here, in the sense that how many people are using this application? I mean, this is being used by all of Microsoft support worldwide? The Metropolis platform?
It is, it's not all of Microsoft support yet. So we're rolling out, and right now, like I say, it's Agent Desktop, and it is consumer, it's enterprise. But there are there are things going down now where we are interacting with other groups. CAP, I forget what the acronym is, but they are like MSN support, which is huge. I mean, millions of end users, and they have kind of a different... They have the types of requests that are very fast and quick. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't connect, you know, here's the thing, oh, thank you very much. And but they're very quick, and we're more the enterprise, the premier, the priority contracts, you know, that kind of stuff. And
But the point is, it's mission critical stuff.
That's really
what we're trying to get at, is that this isn't just, I mean, this is the real deal.
Yeah, and then and then what's coming up, like the conversation we were having as you walked in, is, I mean, the next release, which is exactly what I was just talking about, is now we have to go integrate with these other guys that are up in Redmond.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who are doing the support. They have the data, so that when Vista rolls out, there's going to be a new support model in place. And so what we have now is we have customers who are going to be calling, and some customers are going to be having support contracts with Microsoft, and so they're going to call a number, and they're going to get through to Agent Desktop, our users of our application.
Mm-hmm.
But there's going to be other people who have Vista, and they're going to have a different phone number, and they're going to call, and they're going to land with people who are running CAP.
Mm-hmm.
But we both now have to talk to each other, so all of that's going to be .NET. I mean, we already know we're running .NET web services. Our web services will talk to your web services, yours will talk to mine. We just publish the API. I mean, literally, what we do is we write a business object. We just write our methods and calls, just like we don't care whether this is got to go across a network or it's just a method. We make our calls, we update our database, we do our thing, and then with .NET, you just attribute certain attributes to the method calls and say, make this a web service. And boom, it is now a web service.
Exactly.
And it can be called across HTTP.
Mm-hmm.
And when Windows Communication Foundation, the WCF, comes out, then it even becomes even more robust, because now you'll be able to say, over HTTP, over TCP, over whatever it is, I can change it on the fly, and no code ever changes. You just kind of configure things differently, and it just behaves differently. Kind of back to what I was saying with the remoting that we got to experience. So,
sure. It's awesome.
So,
other companies are starting to move to .NET right now, and probably following you by 5 or 6 years, right? What advice would you have for them, for people who are starting out in .NET right now, knowing what you know now?
The sooner the better.
The sooner the better. Well, I don't know. Do you have tips for them, or things that they should think about architecturally that might be different from the way it used to be done, or you know, let's see the the whip marks on your back, you know, that you learned through your experiences.
Hey.
Performance ideas or tips or.
Well, you know, there's always going to be those things that you still have to design. I mean, it's not a panacea. You can't just, and like I say, and I think I was alluding to that before, we took it as the panacea and it burned us. I mean, if you just think that it's going to solve every problem you ever had, it won't. You still have to be conscious of memory consumption, or you're just going to consume it. The fact that it ultimately might get cleaned up later doesn't help you if you're just chewing up chunks of memory without regard, believing that, well, garbage collection answers every problem I ever had. You can't do that. You also still need to design your transactions and what makes sense. Should I get a lot of data a little bit of times, or should I make a lot of little trips you still have to do that. So on the one hand, I would say it's still caution. You know, you still don't forget that you have to design, you still have to architect, you have to be smart about it. But as far as when it comes down to just writing the code, there's just nothing but good things to say. It just, like I say, with the IntelliSense and the fact that you're, I rarely open up the SDK documentation. I just don't need to. Mm-hmm. You know, in research, when you're doing design, you want to find out what the classes are, what things are available to you. Sure, then you're in looking around, seeing what you can find in samples and doing that stuff. But once you know what you're doing, and you know that it's doable, and you know that you've got a design that's implementable, you just go in and you're just there, and it's Control J, and it just pops up, says, well, here's my object, and here's the things that I can do to it, and it just tells you, and then as you type that open parentheses, oh, and now let me take you one by one. It's like TurboTax. Mm-hmm. It just, here, first thing I need is a PID, you know, and so here, a PID is a text string that's blah, 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 and it just explains it to you. So you go, you hit the comma, and it moves to the next parameter, exactly. And it's just taking you through that stuff. I mean, I can't, yeah. I cannot imagine. I had to go back and do a C++ thing after 2 years of doing C#, and I didn't know how quickly I could forget. I opened it up and I, what are all these files, these HPP things and these CPP things, and why is my code all mixed up? It's all over the place. And it's like, wow, I had just forgotten what I used to have to go through. Right. And every time you'd get, what was that API again? It was user login, user log on, user, was that an O or an I? Is it a capital? Is it not? And, you know, no help. I mean, you just go get the, you have to look it up. And with .NET, all that stuff is just gone. If you can just get close, yeah. It'll pop up and it'll tell you what it is. And it's just, sure. I mean, that stuff's cool.
Now, you know, I will just point out, because I've been doing a bunch of interviews with the Visual C++ team, they've done a tremendous amount of work in VC 2005. To also have a really, really awesome IDE experience where you get code completion, you get right. Where you can. I mean, in the Win32 libraries, of course, there's no XML commenting. Right. So you're not going to get that stuff. But it's at the point now where in C++, you can still write a nice managed app in C++ if you wanted to.
Right. And my C++ experience ended when C# showed up.
That's, fair enough.
That's when it went away.
You're not going back.
Except for that one day I had to go back into C++, and I just, wow.
For, oh, if an
pointers. Ooh, pointers. Okay.
If an advanced developer came in here, what would you be showing them in your code that you're really proud of, or bragging, hey, look at this, you know, or...
If an advanced developer came in...
Well, Charles is an advanced developer.
Well, the remoting stuff is technically the coolest. You know, I suppose one other aspect that I like about this is that, I mean, .NET is really basically putting a wrapper around Windows. So it isn't like the code that you get... And I think this is largely why the pre-beta version of .NET was so stable, is because you're kind of expecting APIs to just not work. But the fact is they did, because they were just calling the underlying Windows APIs, right? You know, duh. Once you finally figure that out, and you go, oh, this isn't all the magic that you, your perception is. But probably the most complicated code that I wrote for Metropolis was a managed library that wraps up all the security ACLs and stuff, putting permissions on folders. You know, as we deploy our systems through production and stuff, you have to build shares and you have to put permissions on and add and remove and stuff. And the early version of .NET just didn't provide that. So everything had to be interop. You had to, which was really the nice bailout, is that you could commit totally to .NET and C#, even though it had nothing to support it, because the bailout is, when it's just not there, you can always call the Win32 API. You can call it natively by going through the interop. So that's what we did. So we wrote a library that basically encapsulated all the ACLs, and we could create shares and folders and do all of that kind of stuff.
Excellent.
And now, on our next release, when we move up to .NET 2.0, I get to go delete all that code. Because .NET has now wrapped all that stuff, and they've provided support. And so this is just like tens of thousands of lines of code that I get to just throw away. I love deleting code.
And why is that? What makes a developer love to delete code? You would think that
I do because
that you become religious about it. It's like, I wrote that code. I don't want to throw it away.
No, every time I delete a line of code, that's one less line that can fail. That's the way I look at it. I mean, I remember, I think what sold me in one of my earlier experiences outside of here, this was back when we were writing under OS2, actually. It was Windows NT was a thing of the future, and we were doing the OS2, the presentation manager client. And there was a thing, and I remember there was a function, a graphics function, it had 99K, I think, was the size of the text file, and it had 28 bugs. And I went in and I fixed the 28 bugs by deleting 2/3 of the code. I mean, or a third of the code. It was just like, and it really was amazing that you come and things get added and superfluous things get done, and when you just start getting rid of extra stuff, it's amazing how much better things just work in general. So totally. I start there. I mean, I really do. When I start looking at bugs, the first thing that I'll be looking at, just personally, is, well, if I don't understand what this, why is that there? Let's, what happens if we just get rid of it? Doesn't, what is that? So yes, I do. I like to delete stuff, and I know that there's bugs in all of that security stuff. It's nothing that's affecting us, but I'm sure there's paths that we've never exercised that were coded for, but if you never exercise it, you don't know. So I know there's bugs sitting there laying in wait, and now they don't matter.
That's true.
You know, now they're gone because I'm quite certain that the .NET code has been tested all the way through all of the paths. You know,
absolutely.
You get to leverage the resources of the product group.
So when you read those articles that I've seen in the, I guess it was Slashdot or somewhere, where they were talking about, we've run this code through a tool and we've now guaranteed that there are no bugs in it. It's kind of like, yeah, and other fairy tales.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that
this wasn't a Microsoft product. This was not a Microsoft product.
But I mean, the point is, like you were saying, gives you lots of surface errors, potential bugs, because you never know how someone's going to use your code. So you never know under all conditions at all times. So when you can limit the code base, when you can shrink it down, you're limiting the effect, the possibility for bugs.
Exactly.
But you're not eliminating bugs, obviously.
No.
But you're decreasing the possibility of them to sprout up.
That's right. If I got 10,000 lines of code, the chances of there being two bugs is greatly more than if I have 10 lines of code.
Yes.
I mean, it just is. Yeah. And so.
Very cool. So with managed code, you've written, You're finding that you're writing less code to do the same or more amount of equal functionality from back in the old days when you weren't writing managed code.
Orders of magnitude. Tons. I mean.
Now, what about debugging too? You got to admit the debugging in VS is pretty nice, huh? it's good stuff.
It is, and it's like magic to me sometimes. I mean. The other day, I mean, I was hacking around. I mean, it was just a proof of concept thing. There was some, we've got some structure, and a part of this integration thing is that we wanted to kind of change the way we did error handling back, just to make a long story short. So we have a lot of infrastructure that was designed specifically around not providing any information to the caller, because the caller would have been the client, and we just don't want any juicy information going back to the client. So everything server-side gets trapped, and then we send down these really worthless, simple things, create customer failed, go look at the server to find out any details, as opposed to foreign key constraint in the database call yielded, you know, a duplicate entry on such and such a table on server such and such, which is just information you don't want to put on the wire on the open internet. So I'm in. And I'm building this stuff, right? So I put together a web service here using Visual Studio, and I do the same thing using our approach where we build a business object and then generate some code, and I generate a proxy. And I just got all this stuff kind of going on, all in a single solution. So I've got every project right there at the left. And I went in to hit debug, and I'm running this little client app that's calling all these different ways of hitting this web service and all the different ways that I had just generated it. And without even really thinking about it, when I stepped into the code, I went from my client app and it stepped into the web service on the server. And now I'm debugging on the server, and I just thought, how did that happen? That's cool. Yeah. I would have never, if I'd have thought about it, I wouldn't have even clicked step into the line of code. Yeah. Because it was literally going across the wire to hit the web server. Right. And just completely transparent to me. I did nothing to enable that, and it just was there, and it just showed up, and I just thought, that's the closest I can come to that comment about debugging. It's just like unexpected value if you look at it in that way. I didn't do anything to make that happen, and yet there it was.
Sure.
Never would have even expected that I should be able to do that, yet there it was.
Fantastic.
So that's cool.
Very good.
Excellent. So Metropolis is a platform of the future for support, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that now we've got this thing that sits out there, and we've built all the infrastructure, so we have a distribution model. We have, you know, error reporting. The client just reports things up. And then we have administrative tools, which are .NET also, mm-hmm. where we can go in and, like those errors that we were just seeing, what I would do is come into our other, this is again a fat client that is going to be what we use to monitor what's going on. So we would come in and look at the error reports, and this is the different environments that we have. Mm-hmm. But the client would have, when that error was encountered, mm-hmm. would have responded by, and I was just telling you that we never send any juicy information down to the client.
Sure.
So what we do is say, you know, this didn't work, and then the client will turn around and respond and record that. Give them an option to say, you know, do you want to record it or don't? And actually that one just automatically recorded it because whatever it was, we wanted to know about whether the user wants us to know or not.
Sure.
So then it turns around, makes a web request, and basically says, this is what the user experience was, and here is the corresponding entry that's already been recorded on the server. Mm-hmm. And then we can go directly to the juicy stuff that tells mm-hmm. me, and I know that I'll go in here and I'll see exactly what went wrong.
Excellent.
So this is what we get. We get, you know, lots of these error information. And looks like, oh, yeah. So we get, you know, our complete stack trace and, you know, right down to the line numbers. It tells me, I mean, this is all stuff that we never had.
Sure.
There's so much of this stuff I take for granted now. Mm-hmm. I go back to before .NET, and I remember we had a guy, a contractor, and the stack trace thing was always something that I always wanted. It was always frustrating to know I have a problem, and I would just love to know. I mean, here's, you know, 120 lines of code, and I'm in a catch block, and I know it happened somewhere in there, but man, which one was it? And we could just never get that. And I remember for a long time, I had this guy say, you know, he was this guy who loved, like, assembly. He was a bit twiddler. I mean, he just loved getting that gnarly stuff, and he wasn't much on the business world, you know, don't give me business rules and stuff. Give me that hard thing. Mm-hmm. And we just said, is there any way that you can in C++ with what we have today? Can you unravel the stack? Can you get into this? And I mean, he got into that, and he spent weeks and weeks and weeks, and then we never really got anything mm-hmm. that would work. And then .NET shows up, and it's just part of it. It's just, it's built right in. And that's just, you get an error, and it takes you to the line of code that says, you know, null reference exception, and you know that it's line 67. Mm-hmm. There it is. There's your answer. And you go, oh, yeah, well, that's stupid. Yeah. So you fix your, mm-hmm. and you check for nullity, and you're done. And before, you would have been saying, well, is it 67 or 128? How many different objects am I using, any one of which could have generated that error? And
you get these ridiculous error codes. And I mean, the exception model that they created in the CLR was one of the high points. One of those things that sells managed code. I mean, we don't advertise very much in a marketing sense, but the exception model was very nicely done, and developers really appreciate it.
Yeah, and you don't have the legacy. I mean, everything's derived from exceptions, so that, you know, it's not like, well, almost everything, but there's some legacy stuff, you know, that we couldn't deal with. And
sure.
I mean, the fact when it all got written from scratch, from start, you just.
Yep. Cool, and it's evolved nicely in 2005, and it'll be interesting that you're going to find some dandy things. Now, in your 2000, your SQL solution, are you using the cache? So when you update your SQL, you can automatically clean out the related cache in your middle tier?
We do not do that.
Okay, you're not playing with that. That's a cool UConn feature.
Yep, and I think, I'm not sure why... Don't remember. I remember it came up. I remember looking at it, and it could have just been one of those things we said, future, we'll take a closer look at it. I'll tell you what we are using in Yukon, though, that was just the cat's meow, is their encryption capabilities that they have now. They introduced an entire infrastructure for managing private keys and doing encryption and hiding data in the database. Hmm. And man, does that solve problems at all levels for us, because now we can create an environment database that's protected by a master key. It always comes down to where do you hide. No matter what secret you have, you got to go hide it somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so you can encrypt it and hide it somewhere, but the fact that you encrypt it means you got another secret that you use to encrypt it, and you got to hide that somewhere. And it's this chicken and the egg thing, is how do you stop it? And I mean, the way you end up stopping is the data protection API, but that always meant that only works, that what makes it work is it's a per box thing. And if you've got a web form that has 10 boxes in a cluster and each one has to, it's a maintenance nightmare to put secrets on the boxes and stuff. And so we were always looking for better ways to do this. Well, UConn comes along now, and so now you've got these environments with a master key and a series of hierarchical keys protected by other keys that each have their own purpose and for large chunks of data, and then you can digitally sign Sprock so that you need special permissions to be able to decrypt the data, but you can just use the key to sign a Sprock so that someone without special permissions can encrypt the data. So you can always put data into the database and encrypt your social security number and your Visa number and that sort of thing, but you'll never have permissions to get it back out again unless you go through this other thing. And by doing all of that, now we put all of our secrets into SQL. I don't have to mess with machine stores on boxes all over the place. I don't have to deal with it here and there. And so every component just goes to the database, and when we need a secret, we get it, and it goes back over SSL. It's encrypted the whole way.
Excellent.
You know, with 2.0, now they actually have secure strings and things. That's an improvement. I mean, now we're getting into the, you know, for those real security guys, well, what happens when you have a password that's in memory and you get a core dump? Well, we don't suffer a lot from hackers getting core dumps of our machines, but I mean, that's a good problem to solve. Yeah. And so .NET is moving ahead and they're solving that. So now you'll have a class that you can get it, and then it will blank it out.
You know, excellent.
Things like that. So,
very cool. Well, this has been enlightening.
Yeah.
Huh?
A lot of fun.
Yeah, what a great, this is a huge project, fully .NET. Nice. That's beautiful.
All the way .NET.
Every
single thing.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Has every big payoffs for our customers, too. You know, they
and
get their support.
Support people.
Does. We got happy customers. We got people all over the world that love the performance. They love the UI. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're away from the browser. The distribution problems, we can roll things out at will. There's just so many good things that are going on. And if this had been done in something other than .NET, it wouldn't be nearly as robust. Very likely could have been done, but it would have taken more people more time, and you'd have more code doing it, and I guarantee it would have more bugs. I know it would. It just...
Fantastic.
Interesting.
Well, perfect. Well, hey, thank you for your time.
Well,
this has been great.
Nice view at your window, by the way.
Yeah.
This is
nice.
So this is Sammamish. That's Sammamish campus.
You guys have like a big marsh over there to the left, which is also nice.
Yeah, and there's Lake Sammamish. If you want to walk a little bit farther, you know, it's walking distance.
Nice.
You can get right on over and look at the ducks.
Cool. Yep. All right. Well, let's head back to Redmond School.
Yeah, thanks.
All right.